Welcome, everybody, to another episode of the Perceptive Podcast. I am Josh Beiser, and we have a great cast for you today. Our topic is going to be talking about crowdfunding, and we have two recent examples of games to look at. But first, let me introduce my guest for this episode. Please welcome returning fan of the site, Paul Tobiah.
Hey, Josh. Thanks for having me on again.
Yeah, Paul, it's great to catch up. I think you were last on, like a year or so ago? I think it's been a while.
Yeah, at least a couple months, that's for sure.
Oh, yeah. So, before we get rolling with our main topic tonight, let's do a little bit of catch-up. So, how have things been going with you?
Very well. Been quite busy with work and family usually. You know, that's one of the things when you get to be, you know, over 40 and but still a gamer. It's finding that balance between everything. But I've been able to get in some decent gaming lately and enjoying, you know, a lot of PC gaming recently.
Cool. And I know we're going to be talking more about some of the games we've played later for our main topic, but any interesting titles you've been playing on and off over like the last few days?
I've been kind of bouncing around a little bit, looking at the Steam sales, and I jumped on the most recent Humble Bundle, so picked up things like, you know, Skullgirls and Gang Beasts and Sir, You Are Being Hunted, right? Some stuff that I was interested in before but kind of flew under the radar, but, you know, when they wind up in a Humble Bundle, you can't beat the price on that. So playing around with those things. Mini Metro, actually, an early access game that I just jumped on board with, is kind of fun. It's a very simple game. It's a puzzle game. It's basically you take a subway or a metro map and you play that. So it's kind of a management game where you're trying to build a transportation network, but the entire UI is just a subway map. There's nothing beyond primary color lines simple shapes and white background and stuff like that.
So. Yeah, I saw that game. I think a few people were talking about that on Broken Form. How are you finding that? Because it looks pretty interesting.
It's got a really nice aesthetic. The UI is very Prezi, right? It doesn't. You never change screens. It just slides and zooms and rotates and stuff. So it's got a lot of style to it. The game itself, you know, it's basically you're drawing, you know, either a blue line between these two dots or a red line between these two dots, and then new dots show up. So there's some efficiencies and depth to it, but it's definitely, you know, a popcorn, you know, half an hour before bedtime kind of throw it on and play around with it.
Awesome. I've been catching up with Darkest Dungeon. I just recently played Rebel Galaxy, which is pretty interesting. I'm not a huge space sim type person, but the game, I think, has a lot of allowances in its design and its UI for people who haven't played stuff like, I don't even know any good examples of space games. That's how unknowledgeable I am at it. I would say the big game I've been playing a lot would be Renowned Explorers from Abbey Games. Basically a sort of like a strategy RPG meets roguelike. Very challenging game. I've put up like 20, 25 different videos of it already. So I'm definitely enjoying it. And other than that, I have been playing Prison Architect, which is actually going to lead into our talk, which I think we'll probably get to right now.
Very cool. I do have to say, though, I am really, really excited about Rebel Galaxy. I do like what those guys have done in the past, you know, with Torchlight and stuff like that. And I like the look of the game. I saw your walkthroughs and your playthroughs that you're doing right now. Mm-hmm. And I am definitely day one on that. And I'm actually kind of disappointed that you can't jump in on early access or pre-order or stuff like that with those guys. So
yeah.
I'm going to be there day one, that's for sure.
That's the weird thing. I was reading some posts. I think Travis made a post either on Quarter 3 or Broken Form, one of the two, about I think Steam wouldn't let them do it, or the game wasn't big enough, or they weren't big enough to warrant a pre-order program or something like that.
That's what I read too. Yeah, it's like they were too small for pre-orders, but you can't be too small for early access. So maybe it's the idea of, you know, pre-orders, you kind of take the money and run, and you never have to release anything, you know, if you get a pre-order. Mm-hmm. At least with early access, you get something out of it, maybe? I don't know.
Yeah, weird.
Yeah.
I just lost Well, I was just about to say there's one other game. Oh, yeah, now I remember. The other thing I'm really excited about at this time of the recording, this is October 10th, and Payday 2 is having their annual big event called Crime Fest in a few days, where they're basically going to do like a week or two of just updates and announcements for the game. So I'm definitely excited about that and seeing what they're going to do. They've been running this crazy marketing campaign for the game. Have you heard about this, Paul?
I haven't really gotten into Payday 2, but I know that, I mean, from my outside view, right? I mean, it's kind of an amazing grassroots story, right?
Yeah.
The game's been out for, what, almost a year now?
It's like 3-year anniversary.
Holy cow. And it's still going strong. I mean, talking about, and I think that's some of the things we'll be talking about with Prison Architect and Planetary Annihilation Titans, but, you know, this idea of not necessarily being an MMO or an MMO model, but supporting a game throughout a extended shelf life, and it seems like it's paying off for those Payday guys.
Yeah, now they've ran into definitely some issues with misconceptions, and especially with their pricing model. It's not like a game like Planetary Annihilation or Prison Architect, where they're supporting the game with free content. They've been rolling out DLC. I think it's been like a 3 or 4 week cycle for like the last year or so. They've definitely I don't know if I want to say abandoned, but they've definitely pushed aside more the realistic side of the game. They've now have, you can buy medieval weaponry, there is a Wild West pack at some point, and they're just going for content. I mean, if you look at the Steam page, there it's just like overflowing with DLC and stuff to buy. So the big event that they've been doing, which is a very interesting marketing event that they do every year, is they put challenges up for the community to do, like beat so-and-so heist 500,000 times, or collect X amount of experience or whatever, and if the whole community does it, it will unlock some kind of free thing during the marketing event. So they did last year, they did the year before, and so far with this one, it looks like everyone's done, they're going to do all the events. So they definitely know how to keep the game going. And as you said, Paul, I think this is going to be a great lead-in to our main topic today.
I'm looking at the Steam page, and there is $110.73 worth of DLC on there.
Yeah, and the incredibly weird part is that that's still not the most I've seen for some games. Like, a few weeks ago, I bought Europa Universalis as part of the Humble Bundle, Build Your Own Bundle or something promotion, and I had no idea what I was buying. I had to actually ask people in Broken Form Bell because I just didn't know, you know, what am I getting here? Am I buying this? And then when I looked, there were still like 20 or 30 different DLCs that I didn't own after buying everything on the Humble Bundle. And then, of course, we got stuff like Farm Simulator, Euro Truck, Train Simulator. And, you know, they have, like, DLC in, like, the 200 to 300s. I mean, it's definitely crazy how developers are going for the long game with supporting their titles. And it can pay off, but as we've seen with some games such as Space-Based DF9, if you're planning for, like, 3-4 years of funding and you don't get it or you don't properly manage it, the whole thing can just come crashing down on you.
Yeah.
And I think with that, that takes us to our main topic tonight. I know this is probably going to be a shortened cast, but of course, every time I say that, we'll run for like 2-3 hours. But we'll try to keep this on the short side for tonight. But our topic, as we've said, is about crowdfunding. And more specifically, about some of the recent hit and misses of the platform. So, as Paul said a few seconds ago, the two games we're talking about tonight are Prison Architect and Planetary Annihilations, or I guess what we can technically call it, Planetary Annihilations Titan. And I think we'll start with that game first, because that one has definitely shown, I won't say the dark side, but it can show what happens when things are, when expectations are not met. So, obviously, Paul, you definitely know about what Planetary Annihilation is. I think we spoke about when you were on last time.
Yep.
So I'll do a brief recap for those of you listening who haven't been following it. And Paul, feel free to jump in if I miss anything or if you want to add anything.
Yep.
So Planetary Annihilations was the crowdfunded, or I should say Kickstarter, title from Uber Entertainment. It was originally pitched as both a spiritual successor to Total Annihilation and as sort of the welcoming home of the big macro-oriented RTS games. Because as we all know, we've definitely seen a shift to smaller unit counts, more micro-management, stuff like StarCraft II, for instance. When it went on Kickstarter, they had just a laundry list of goals and stretch goals to go for. There's a grand procedurally generated campaign, different planets, full orchestral soundtrack, you know, the whole deal. And they hit it. I think they were asking like $250,000 originally. And I think they ended up with, I think, over $2 million. I think. It's been a while since I looked at the Kickstarter page. But to put it simply, they had success on Kickstarter. Right up there with Double Fine, with Broken Age. So, game was put on like early alpha. You could anyone who pledged enough money could get into it. They eventually rolled out a beta program. Game was put on early access. And it was eventually released, I believe the first version was released last September, if I remember right. Somewhere around that. And the game was just hit with negative reviews. I know, Paul, when we played, I think last year, I think you, me, Tom, and Jason from Quarter 3, we all tried to get a 2-on-2 going,
yep.
And we just had nothing but trouble getting that game to work, trying to get the game to actually play right. It was a system hog, for one thing. The UI really didn't work for novice players, and I think we just abandoned the game after like an hour and a half of playing. And as I said, the game was hit with a lot of negative reviews. A lot of people criticized Uber for calling this 1.0 when things like in-game saves were done. The Galactic War, which was their grand campaign, didn't really work. The AI was very busted. And it just seemed like a game that was aimed for the super competitive esports, you know, the expert level players. And this actually inferred... Or, I'm sorry, it trickled down into when they were doing another Kickstarter for the game, the Human Resources, which was supposed to be like a... I'm not even sure how to describe. It was definitely more macro-oriented, but it was like more like monsters and robots rather than... Yeah,
it was kind of pulled in a little bit. It wasn't... the big thing about Planetary Annihilation was the scale, right? You fought across an entire solar system, taking your army from planet to planet. The idea about Human Resources was it was still a high unit count. You know, kind of the difference in my mind between macro and micro is that with macro, you know, you're talking about the army makeup and moving large armies versus the micro. The ultimate extreme of micro is what the MOBAs have turned into, right? Where you've got one unit that you've got all these powers and you're managing. So I think Human Resources kind of fell in the middle, but the problem was in my perception, in my opinion, Planetary Annihilation was very focused on the they went very competitive oriented at the beginning. It was very much tuned towards the people who had been playing it for a long time, which was evidenced by our game that we had, where I was kind of teaching everything to you guys, but there was nothing there in the game that was telling you guys how things worked or how it moved around. And Planetary Annihilation had such a difference. I know that, you know, people are getting stuck on the idea that, well, I got to spin this planet around and I don't have full situational awareness of everything that's going on at any one location. Well, that's kind of the case of any RTS.
Yeah.
You know, you are really only focusing on one corner of the map or one piece of the map and being able to move between that. So there was a lot of differences and there wasn't really any kind of hand-holding. They were kind of catering to the people who were the backers. They were catering to the people who had a in my opinion, that had more of a competitive bent. So when they released their 1.0, it was a decent product in terms of that it actually worked and it, you know, it accomplished the things that they needed to do, but it was very very hostile towards new players.
Yeah.
And then, unfortunately, I think, and this is, you know, 100% supposition on my part, right? That's when they started running out of money from their early access and from the crowdfunding, because they had multiple opportunities for people to jump on board. It wasn't just the 2.2 million that they got in the Kickstarter, but they had, you know, different packages and stuff as time was passing by. So they had to shift to their next thing, and that's why they started that human resources Kickstarter. But the problem was is that maybe the hardcore people who backed Planetary Annihilation and were really into that competitive kind of mm-hmm. mode, they were happy with Planetary Annihilation. Nobody else was. So yeah. Why am I going to pay you another $60 when you didn't give me what I gave you the $100 for last time?
Yeah. Right? And they also, I think, really just bungled the whole early access and trying to raise more money side of things. There was a huge hoopla when they released the alpha pack for, I think, $80, $90 on early access, like day one. And people were generally upset, you know, like, why should I, you know, $90 for this? Why should I spend that? Especially yeah. when we talk about our next game, Prison Architect, which it was released originally at $40. I think right now it's like, I think it's like $30 retail. But we'll talk more about what they did in a few minutes. And the other thing that Planetary Annihilation screwed up on, I think as you said, Paul, it sounds like they really did run out of funding. I know one of the things they were hitting at throughout the alpha was the unit cannon, which allows you to, you know, shoot units from one planet to another. I think it took them like 6 months to a year before that was actually implemented in. Yep. And I think it even took them longer to actually put in-game saves. And I think right there, I think that's a good smoking gun evidence to what you just said, Paul, that they were aiming for the hardcore, super competitive esports crowd. Because that kind of crowd, they don't care about in-game saves. They're just going to play a single match and be done with it. But for, you know, someone like you and me and other people who are trying to learn the game or we're trying to play multiple games over like span of several days, that kind of functionality is usually a given. And having not in there at for version 1.0 kind of, you know, speaks about the quality of the product.
Absolutely. But I do have to say, to their credit, they took that to heart, right? When they got smacked around with human resources failing, they kind of went dark. They did a couple of updates here and there for Planetary Annihilation. Mm-hmm. But my understanding, I've heard rumors about the possibility of doing a Monday Night Combat 2, which I would love. Uber, mm-hmm. if anybody's listening, please, I hope you're working on that. I'll sign up for that one day one. But really what they did then, I believe, is that they went back and they fixed it. And if you take a look at Titans, if you take a look at Planetary Annihilation Titans in a vacuum, you don't look at the history, you don't look at the crowdfunding, mm-hmm. you look at that as a $40 macro RTS game, it's a pretty damn good game. A lot of the issues and problems that you had, that we had with Planetary Annihilation 1.0 is kind of fixed. Mm-hmm. They actually have a freaking tutorial in there, and it's not a YouTube video. They actually walk you through, and they walk you through some of the things like camera anchor points, right? Which is how they get past the mini-map idea, right? So that you can have, you know, anchor points on one or more planets so you can switch back between them very, very quickly. Things like the queue, the factory queues, and how to move units from one planet to another with a lander. Stuff like that is actually built into the tutorial.
My God. It's going to snow now. It's amazing. they
actually have tooltips. If you hover over a unit, it'll tell you what it does. It'll tell you how many hit points that it has, and it'll tell you what it's good and bad against. So I gotta give them credit, right? I mean, Planetary Annihilation Titans is the game that Planetary Annihilation should have been. If they came out with that a year before and said, here's Planetary Annihilation, I think you would have a completely different opinion and attitude about that company and about that game. So, and unfortunately, you know, they kind of burned their bridges and it took them a year to do it. Yeah. It's a little bit kind of like my friends over at Kerberos, right, with Sword of the Stars 2. Mm. It took them a year to really, I mean, the game that they released was almost unplayable. Yeah. they officially did their 1.0, right? And there's a whole story around that. You can go talk to Martin Cerulis or Chris Stewart about that. But you know, it took them a year to fix it and turn it into an actual passable game. So I think that that's one of the scary things about this kind of crowdfunding early access. And to talk about Prison Architect, right? I don't know what their original time frame was, but it took them 3 years to get to 1.0.
And I really want to jump into Prison Architect because there's so much to talk about. But yeah, definitely keep that in the back of your mind for the next few minutes, Paul, because we're really going to jump into PA. Or actually, they're both PA. How's that for you? Coincidence. But getting back to Planetary Annihilation, as you said, Paul, it took them an extra year. So I think they did the Kickstarter, I think, in 2012, 2013. The game was released technically the end of 2014, and then it took them another year to sort of get that going. But you made a really good point there about if you look at Planetary Annihilation's Titan in just a complete vacuum, like pretend that other game never existed, it looks like it's a lot better. From what you've played of it, Paul, I haven't had a chance to jump in. I've been just swarmed lately. But from your general impressions, is it that much of an improvement besides what you just said with the tooltips and the tutorial? But in terms of like design and just playability, is it that much of an improvement?
It is. There's been a lot of balancing and a lot of AI fixes as well as the UI. The base game is still there, right? I mean, if you're talking about, right, if you're looking for a micro game, right, go get Grey Goo. That's an awesome RTS game, right? And production values through the roof. So Planetary Annihilation is still that, you know, kind of zoomed out, you're fighting across planets. It's not what units you have. It's do you have 100 of these plus 100 of these, right? On the and it is about the, you know, the rate limit on your economy, right? It's the continual growth and expansion, and you know, a little bit of the scouting and understanding what they're doing. So the base game itself hasn't changed, and believe me, right, they haven't fleshed out anything about the world or anything like that. Even with the Galactic War, it is still just a series of roughly procedurally generated missions that you do that includes your tech tree, right, and you make choices about can I build bots versus build orbitals and things like that. So the base game itself hasn't changed too much, but they have, you know, they've added the units that they've needed to, right? They've added the submarines. They've added another half a tier. They haven't officially created a tier 3, but they've created more, not just the big Titan super units, which is kind of a thing that Supreme Commander was known for, and especially Supreme Commander 2, but they've also created higher tier, even though they're still tier 2 units, you know, like super interceptors that can go between planets. They've added submarines. They've added, all right, so they've kind of fleshed out the units as well. And then, you know, just with that extra level of polish on it, it hasn't changed the game, in my opinion, but it's made the game what you would expect from a full-priced RTS, you know, AAA type game.
Yeah. And I know they've also added in the titular, the Titans now, like having actual super units too. Originally, your commander was sort of, you know, powerful, but it runs out of health, you lose. So you couldn't really put him or it into the fray. But now they're sort of going the route of what they did, I think, with... I did not play too much... Oh, wait, I actually did play. In Supreme Commander, where you had these massive super units that you could build... and just like have like that end game or late game finisher.
I think that again shows you the difference between the competitive, right? You look at any competitive RTS game, you know, again, Grey Goo I put as another example, right? You never get to the end units. You barely ever get to the tier 2 units, right? Everything is fought at tier 1. Everything is fought with those starting units, and it's those little bits of economic advantage and micromanagement of your battles and things like that. Again, even happening in Planetary Annihilation. And I would rarely ever see a competitive match in Planetary Annihilation get to tier 2, let alone get to any kind of huge end game units like that. But if you and I are just playing a comp stomp, well, you know, maybe we will turtle up and build some super units, but that But then that allows you, right, because once you get built up, once you own two planets and you have two planets completely churning out units, right, versus the enemy's two planets that's completely churning out units, you can run into a stalemate pretty quickly. And those Titans, those end units, are supposed to be those late-game breakers. Because even the end units in the base game of Planetary Annihilation, stuff like the unit cannon when it came out and nuclear missiles and... Well, running a planet into another planet is a good game ender as well. and the piece that they added as well with the metal planet of being able to do the tier 2 buildings on it and turn it into a Death Star to blow up another planet, right? So those were definitely those end game stalemate breakers that they did have built into Planetary Annihilation in the first place. But in this, you can build a bunch of interplanetary battleships and go wipe them out and things like that, so you don't have to smash planets into other planets to finish the game.
Cool. One other thing I wanted to bring up, another thing that they sort of, I think, had trouble with the original Planetary Annihilation, was they gave you the option to buy, they had the in-game store where you could buy new commander skins and stuff like that, and a lot of people felt that was pushing things into DLC territory, and I know that wasn't the case. All the commander skins were just cosmetic.
Mm-hmm.
But as we said, they kind of burned a lot of their bridges with how they handled Planetary Annihilation. And it sounds like what you're saying with Titans, it sounds like it's more of what we were hoping for 3 years ago than what we got last year.
I mean, give them credit, right? They've learned. Yeah. They've learned from their mistakes. You know, it isn't. They're not coming out with the DLC pieces, and they had some weird stuff going around that, because if you were at the alpha level, you got certain commanders. If you were at the beta level, you got certain commanders. There was even, they had 1.4 tournament wins. They would have unique commanders that you'd win for winning a tournament, and then they had one that they did for a charity thing that they were doing. If you donate a certain amount to a charity, you'd get a particular commander, stuff like that. It was a little tone deaf. It was a little, you know, seeing if they could keep the stream going, and mainly because the prices for them were like $5 to $10 for yeah, a skin, and honestly, you know, again, it's a macro RTS. You're not spending a whole lot of time zoomed in on your commander, you know, even looking to see if the commander's got treads or four wheels or two arms or one arm, you know. So it was a little tone deaf from that perspective, and I think they learned about it. And if you look at how they launched Titans, right, there was a couple of media outlets and super fans who knew about it, but they kind of threw it on it. It's like, hey, by the way, we're going to relaunch in terms of Planetary Annihilation Titans. You can't, I don't believe you can go to the Steam store for Planetary Annihilation anymore. It's just Titans from here on out. So they were kind of looking for that relaunch, kind of looking for that do-over. Same thing that my friends at Kerberos did when they came out with their, you know, extended edition that added the DLC onto it, and you just bought it one time for everything.
Yeah, and I know, like, as you're just saying, I didn't get any real update that they were doing until it was literally out, and they said, oh, if you bought Planetary Annihilation or you kickstarted it, it's yours free. That was it. That was my only bit of word that they're doing something like that.
And by the way, it's available today.
Yeah, exactly. And I think this goes back to, as we've been talking about, like, the last 10 or so minutes, that Uber definitely, and this may actually lead into what we'll talk about with Prison Architect in a few minutes, but Uber definitely surrounded themselves with their hardcore fans. They were only listening to what they wanted, only doing what they thought would help. And I think that's sort of what hurt the original Planetary Annihilation. They were basically in their own little echo chamber of hardcore fans. And as you said, with what they've changed with Titans, adding more tutorials, tooltips, stuff like that, it sounds like they are starting to learn their lesson and trying to open the game up to more of an audience.
I mean, the competitive part is definitely part of it, but I would think that, and again, complete supposition on my part, I don't know anybody over at Uber Games or anything, but I think, you know, how do you get a hardcore PC-only RTS how do you get marketing out of that, right? How do you get on the sites,
exactly.
right? Well, it's even with other games, right? It's not so much about the sites. It's about the streamers. It's about the people who are getting out there on YouTube. You yourself, Josh, are doing that, right? I love watching your playthroughs. So how do you do that, right? I think they were catering to the streamers. They were catering to, right, if you can get competitive with an RTS or a competitive game like that, then you get the streamers out there. You get the people interested in it. You build enough of the community where people will come in and buy your game and get things moving, right? I think I kind of see that with some of the shooters nowadays, right? Like Dirty Bomb, Siege that's coming out, Battlefront, Star Wars Battlefront, right? They're definitely leaning more towards, you know, hey, put us up on YouTube so we get, you know, thousands of hits and we make our money that way.
Yeah, and that's a really good point, Paul, and something that I've spoken to a lot of developers about over, like, the last year or two, especially with, as I've been putting more of a focus and emphasis on doing daily streams, daily videos. These videos can do a lot to help people learn the game, and more importantly, it's free publicity. Well, technically, you're giving someone, you know, a $20, $40 game, but if that $40 translates into, you know, 50, 60 more sales, then it was even worth it on that small sense. And then you got, like, the bigger YouTubers, stuff like PewDiePie, Markiplier, and others, or even someone like TotalBiscuit, where, you know, they play a game, they have 300, 400,000 people looking at that game. And if he gives his thumbs up or thumbs down, that could pretty much sink or swim a major game.
Absolutely.
A good example, as I was saying with, like, Rebel Galaxy, I got the key from them to do some streaming and showing that game off early, and I think that's going to be really important for them, not just for me, obviously, but for everyone, because, as we said, they're not allowed to take pre-orders on it. So how else are you going to get that word of mouth and buzz out? Well, let's let people stream it and show the game off. And, as we've said, it has given YouTubers and streamers a lot of power lately, and that is, you know, a whole other discussion we could have right there about just that kind of thing, because we've had issues with that, with people having to declare whether or not they're getting paid or they're getting funded from the developer to stream a game or whatnot. But yeah, I don't want to start that topic because we'll be here for like another hour easily. But before we move on, then, I'm trying to think if there's any other topics regarding Planetary Annihilation. Is there anything you want to touch on to wrap the session up?
So the last thing I want to say, maybe it's not related to the crowdfunding part of it, right? But there is something to be said for people who listen, right? For people who change and move on, right? So. I think that Titans is a good step, and it's a good move, and that they tried to relaunch, you know, whether or not you are so butthurt about what happened with the Planetary Annihilation a year ago that you're willing to throw this really good game in the trash. I think that kind of says a little bit more about the person who's playing the game as opposed to the developers who made it. You know, I give them kudos and props for, you know, in my perception, you know, fixing the problems and trying to come correct so that they rebuild that credibility and cachet so that when they come out with whatever's next, and I do hope they continue on because I've loved their games that have come out, you know, Super Monday Night Combat, Monday Night Combat, and Planetary Annihilation Titans. I've enjoyed all four. There are two of those games. So whether they come out with SMNC 2 or something like that, I hope that they can continue on.
Yeah. And I agree with you on that. It's going to be really interesting to see how the future holds for Uber. Because as you said, it can be very hard to improve and correct your mistakes you've made. And we do have to give them credit for that. I mean, when you look at the original Supreme Commander 2 launch, that was one like the worst games, biggest flops around for the market. And then they spent like 6 months to a year working on it. They got Soren, who was also became the AI designer for Planetary Annihilation, to completely redo the AI, completely redo the game. And when they did like a soft relaunch of like Supreme Commander 2.0 or 2.0, whatever. It was just night and day experience. I think Tom Chick said like it went from like one of his worst games to like he actually enjoyed it. I think he gave like a 1 out of 10 when it was originally released.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
But yeah, and this is definitely going to be an interesting time to see how developers bounce back and keep going or keep sustaining themselves. And I think that's a great springboard to talking about Prison Architect. Because when we're talking about someone sustaining themselves, Introversion has done exemplary work over the last, I think we said, like 3 years. So, to start things off with Prison Architect, obviously for those of you who haven't followed it or haven't read my review or watched any videos, Prison Architect is the Bullfrog-style management sim from Introversion Software. It's about running a prison. Your job, effectively, is you are the warden and the architect. You have to build all the cells, build the prison up, manage all the logistics, try to keep your prisoners in line, of course, prevent any brutal killings, breakouts, and all that stuff. And this was pitched about 3 years ago. Introversion Software, they were seeing the crowdfunding. I think this came out just after Kickstarter blew up. And they said they wanted to do something like that. And they said, we're going to do it, but we're not going to do it on Kickstarter. We're going to do it from our own site. And if you want to help us fund this game, you know, give us $40. Because we only want people who are going to help us make this game. And a lot of people, I think myself included, thought, you know, this isn't going to work. You know, they're not using the hot, you know, the new and hotness of Kickstarter. They weren't going to make that money. And they did. And they really, really, really did. The game got, as you were saying, I think earlier in the cast, Paul, we have no idea what their original plan was for Prison Architect. They could have only spent, you know, 5-6 months on the game and call it quits. But they were able to get 2.5, I think almost 3 years worth of updates out of their early access and crowdfunding model. I think it hit like alpha 28, 29 before they officially said, okay, we're going to make it 1.0 now.
Yeah, well, they announced 1.0 at 29. They said that they were going to do it, but they actually did. There was a, so every, yeah, 36 is the number of, I mean, it's the full 3 years of updates that they did.
Yeah, and to talk about a developer handling crowdfunding and the expectations right, Introversion really just knocked it out of the park. They really have become the poster child for what you can do with crowdfunding and the early access idea. As we just said, 29 updates is amazing. And when it originally started, I think that's the big thing. When they put like out like 1.0 out, it was like literally nothing there. I think it was just like a field and you put a building down, that's it. And they were able to not only keep people engaged with it, but they kept informing everyone about how the game was. Every month, they put out a new update, a new video, and they laid it out clearly. This is what we've done. This is what's in the game. This is what's coming next. You always knew what they were working on. And that, I think, is one of the most important things. I think you yourself or someone else on Broken Forum posted like the videos every month for when they did Prison Architect. And I mean, that's amazing. We see a lot of early access people who they just disappear for like 3-4 months. Okay, and they go, okay, here's a new patch. We'll see you in, you know, 2-8 weeks. You know, enjoy this. We'll check back with you later. But they were really on the ball with it. And it shows. So with Prison Architect, as we said, it's one of the more interesting things. I want to get your opinion on this, Paul. As we said, when they originally announced the funding, they priced it at $40 with the specific intent of this game is going to be cheaper. We just want to get the hardcore in now. And normally when we see games on early access, they go the cheaper route. You know, they'll give you a 15-20% discount and say, oh, buy it now. And then, you know, in a year or two when it goes up, when we're done, it's going to go up $5-$10 or whatever. So what did you think of that strategy, Paul, with them pricing high at the start as opposed to pricing low?
Well, they actually, it was kind of a similar thing that Planetary Annihilation did, right? You had to pay the $90 to play the alpha, right? And then it was like the $60 for the beta and the, you know, whatever it was, 40 on discount or whatever. So I think that that's okay. I mean, the main thing, again, I'm going to reiterate what you mentioned. I think the thing that they really did that knocked it out of the park was that very quickly they provided you with something that was playable, that had at least a little bit of gameplay to it. But then you basically set your calendar by those videos, right? You knew that in the fourth week of every month, there was going to be at least a half an hour of the producer and the lead developer talking, you know, and showing you the game and all of the updates and everything that they've put in the last 30 days for at least a half an hour, if not a whole hour. So for the full 3 years, 36 times they went out and did that, you know, so it wasn't, you knew that things were coming. And even when, you know, they said, hey, this one's going to be just a bug bash, they still came out with another video and said, and they were boring as hell and said, hey, here's all the bugs that we fixed, right? But here's the one little thing that we threw in that actually changes the gameplay. So it was it was that constant communication. I think, you know, as a streamer and a blogger and somebody who's out there, right, it's that podcaster and stuff like that, it's regular content. You know, I always tell my friends who are in this new media and stuff is that if you aren't predictable, if you can't build an audience without being consistent, you know, if you're not out there every week, or if you're not at least communicating to your audience why you're not there out there every month or whatever it is, then people are going to lose interest. It's like, oh yeah, what about that? What about that update to Prison Architect? It's, you know, I think there's, you know, we see on the forums that you and I frequent, right? There's a lot of interesting Kickstarted or crowdfunded games that are out there, and those threads just die.
Yeah.
They go nowhere. And then, you know, 8 weeks later, it's like, oh, yeah, that game. Yeah, that sounds great. Cool. You know, that's nice. Yeah. Did they change anything to it? Eh, not really.
We'll see in another 8 weeks.
Yeah, exactly. So I think it's that communication and consistency allowed them to continue on. Have you ever talked about the history of introversion and how Prison Architect kind of saved the company?
I have not. I know I mentioned on a previous cast that they were one of the first like developers to really go the indie route before that was even a thing, but I haven't delved too far into their history with it. So definitely go ahead.
Yeah, so these guys were back in the day, right, before indie was cool. They're the ones who came out with Darwinia, which was kind of one of those indie darlings that came out. And then they went down the console route, and you actually hear it nowadays with Chris DeLay, the lead developer and kind of the heart and soul of the only guy left from the original Introversion, say, you know, I'm never going to go back to consoles again, because they almost bankrupted the company trying to develop Multiwinia. Right, and in the middle there, they came out with DEF CON, which was a great thing, but they were trying to. So the game after Multiwinia, the game which is basically Chris and I can't remember who the producer was. These are the only two guys that are left. Everybody else got laid off, and he's just, you know, programming out of his house. He's trying to build a heist simulator and a city simulator and a, you know, high tech breaking into stuff and things like that. And he said no matter how the level was designed, that the people would just break it and things would go wrong and they would shortcut stuff, and he would think, well, you have to knock out this guard or you have to avoid this guy in order to reach the junction box to be able to do this, to be able to do that. And the player would just come in and say, yeah, I'm just going to kill this guard and cut the power, right? And so this whole, you know, hours of building this level were just thrown in the bin. So then he flipped the script on it and he said, well, what if you're building the level and the AI is trying to break out? And he was playing Dwarf Fortress, which I would argue it's Prison Architect's a little more like Dwarf Fortress than like a traditional bullfrog, you know, kind of management sim game, where what if you're playing Dwarf Fortress and the dwarfs don't like you? how do you so they're all those little AIs with all their own little, you know, peccadillos and different stuff, and that was the idea of Prison Architect. that he came up with. And again, it's, you know, it's saved the company. And as you mentioned, right, they've been doing pretty well in terms of their ability to not only that initial burst of crowdfunding, but because they've been out there every month saying, here's the game in the current state, people could jump on at any point in time and start playing right away. All right. So if you saw, it's like you take a look at the video two, right? And it's like, Jesus, there isn't really much of a game there. Mm-hmm. You come back a year later at video 14 and it's like, oh, wait a second, that looks kind of fun. Then you throw them the $40, right? Yeah. And then when Steam Early Access started coming on board, they jumped on that. So you could jump into Early Access at any point. So, and then, but once you jumped in, that was it. You know, you're good for the rest of the time.
Yeah.
And they had upgrades like, you know, put your name in the game and put your own prisoner bio and stuff like that in there. But that was, and then the cool thing is that they even held stuff back for the 1.0, right? So even if you played the alpha all the way up till now, there's still a reason to come back, even if you've been playing this game for the last 3 years, with stuff like the escape mode and the events have been a very recent addition, and then the single player campaign, which is a little more tutorial. So, so yeah, that consistency, that, you know, still adds something when you officially come out, so you get people to continue to play and be interested in your game. I completely agree with you. I would put them up as a poster child. I'd put them right next to Harebrain, right, in terms of the Shadowrun guys, in terms of doing Kickstarter, you know, crowdfunding, right?
Yeah, I was. Thanks for reminding me about that, Paul. I was thinking about that before we started the podcast. I completely forgot about them and what they've done. They're another great success story of early access, or I'm sorry, crowdfunding with Kickstarter. They've, I think, what are they up to now? Like four different Kickstarters?
Well, they've done three Shadowrun games, and they just launched BattleTech, which is not first person. It's the top down turn based stuff. Yeah. So,
and I know the BattleTech one. I think they literally hit their goal in like what 24 hours or like 30 minutes of it going up. I think they have won like the records for fastest successful Kickstarter. So, yeah, they know their stuff over there.
Yeah, absolutely.
And getting back to Prison Architect, I guess one of the things I wanted to talk to you about, Paul, especially we both talk about how we've been playing it lately, I want to get your thoughts overall about, I guess, the perception of playing a long-term game. I'm sorry, let me rephrase that, a long-term crowdfunded project. As we said, they were doing this for 3 years. And one of the things that we've said, obviously in the last few minutes, how will they be able to put consistent information up? But as an older gamer, I'm used to buying a game and, you know, it's mine, I'm going to play the hell out of it, and it's done. But when you're playing a game like Prison Architect and a lot of the early access games, you're buying a game and you can play it, but you're really meant to sit on it for, you know, a year, 6 months, whatever. So as someone who's also an older gamer, how do you, like, approach this, or have you changed your play style at all when you have a game like this where you could play it, but you still, you know, 1.0 is still 6 months, 2 years out?
I think that there's been, right, so a lot of the need to play it has been satisfied by, it's been satisfied by two things. One is the videos themselves. So you immediately see what the new stuff is and what would be interesting and whether or not you want to play that. You know, it's show, not tell. It's not a list of patch notes. It's an actual, here, check this out, right? Here's how you do automated doors now, or stuff like that. And then the other thing is their early integration with Steam Workshop. Mm-hmm. And then the developers themselves weren't spending the 15, 20 hours to build this elaborate prison that made use of the new features. They just download off of Steam Workshop those hardcore people who built those prisons, and then you just kind of try them out yourself. Mm-hmm. So I've actually built few prisons on my own, and I've never really gone into the end game from a prison that I've started with. But I'll download Prisons off of Steam Workshop all day long to try out different things and tweak stuff around. So that I haven't done the actual full game loop of starting with just an empty field, getting to this full-blown prison with, you know, maximum, supermax, medium and low security and recidivism and, you know, and all that kind of stuff, riots and events and things like that. I have yet to actually do that, and I'll probably start that now that we're at 1.0. But I've played a bunch of other people's prisons in different ranges and styles that have allowed me to kind of jumpstart that, because that's playing the beginning of a management game, or playing the beginning of a 4X game, or playing the beginning of a strategy game.
Yeah.
Those can get boring if you do it 50 times.
I can attest to that. And that's like a major design discussion right there. But for those of you listening, what we're talking about is the early stages of a lot of management and strategy games. It's all about dealing with a very limited tool set. And because of that, you really are, I guess I don't want to repeat the word, but you are limited in what you can actually do with that. So we find typically that a lot of early game stuff just repeats over and over again, and you don't really get to the big decisions until the mid or late game. We see this with everything from Prison Architect, SimCity. You know, it put any management, city builder, or even 4X game in there, and will usually apply.
City Skylines, how many times that 0 to 10,000, right? Have you gone through that process going from 0 to 10,000 versus clicking the button that says, nah, just give me everything right off the bat. I'd rather play the game that way, right?
So now another part I want to ask you, Paul, regarding Prison Architect and this crowdfunding, the crowdfunding type marketing and design. When we see games go from alpha to retail, one of the, I'm not sure if this would be an expectation or sort of a suggestion, we've seen some developers hold major things, or, you know, save something major so that, you know, it goes from alpha to, oh my god, retail, it's done, look at all this new stuff. And with Prison Architect, as we said, they do have the campaign mode, they do have the escape mode, but in terms of actually playing the game, it's sort of like a quiet release. There's nothing like absolutely brand new systems to work with. With Darkest Dungeon, for instance, they've actually said that the final dungeon, you know, the big ending of the game, that's going to be saved for 1.0. So that they do have that, oh my god, you know, we're now done, look at all this stuff type moment. So for you, Paul, what did you think about how they handled Prison Architect? That's not exactly like a huge release, it's just more like, I guess, taking over from alpha to retail.
I think because of the nature of the game, which is really focused on the sandbox, because you gotta understand that the campaign, quote unquote, is really just a tutorial, right? It shows you the basic mechanics of the game, and that's actually the introductory point for somebody who hasn't been playing the last 29, 36 alphas to play the game. So from a sandbox nature, I think that one of the things that Introversion did, which was interesting, is a year and a half, 2 years into their crowdfunding and early access stuff, they actually opened up their bug database. So they allowed the hardest of the hardcore to actually enter in bugs directly into their bug database on a regular basis. So to be able to provide the entirety of the game loop for that sandbox mode, I think helped them in terms of QA and helped them in terms of fixing and smashing bugs. So yes, the entire game was kind of there and kind of laid out for you. So I do not doubt that there are quite a few people out there who say, you know, oh, big deal, it's 1.0. What's really different from what I've done before? But I think, you know, if you've bought into the concept of early access and you've bought into the idea of, you know, you want to see how the sausage is made and get to play the game early and stuff like that, that's not really what 1.0 really isn't for you then, right? I mean, it's for the people who have said, and for the reviewers and the media and things like that, you know, or at least more traditional media, to actually say, okay, now this is a game. Now I can play it. Now I can pass judgment on it or review it or stuff like that. So,
Definitely. Let's see. I think I have one or two more questions regarding Prison Architect for you, Paul, and then I have just a few general wrap-up questions and for the
Cool.
cast. So this is one I'm definitely curious about. Obviously, again, since you've been following Prison Architect like I have over the last 2.5, 3 years, and I'm just wondering, as we've spent the last 20 minutes or so talking about Prison Architect, we've definitely levied a lot of praise on it and Introversion's decisions of developing the game and sustaining it. So I'm just wondering, and I have something to throw in here too, but I'm just wondering for you, Paul, are there any areas that you think Introversion, I don't want to say messed up on, or but something that they could have improved on with hindsight, or any area that they may have slipped up in your opinion?
I think that the game, I think that the, I think that the game is the end result of this iterative process that they've done, right? The piece to keep it going and to keep it playable for the last 3 years, things seem to be relatively bolted on. Things seem to be, the mechanics and systems seem to be relatively modular. And I don't know if that's a good thing or a bad thing, or if, you know, there's parts of the game that I don't know are even worthwhile or mechanically useful. You know, their entire wiring diagram system and how you do all of that stuff. Some of the stuff when you dig into it, it seems to me like the iterative design process of finding a problem and fixing it has kind of glommed on a whole bunch of systems and information to it that hasn't necessarily cohesively came together in a process that that and again, I don't know if that's just because I've seen the sausage and I've seen those bits and pieces be put into it, as opposed to something at the, you know, at the end point. Like I got to point back to Grey Goo in terms of a system, you know, in terms of a game that has huge production values and UI and cohesiveness and stuff like that, right? Everything seems to kind of fit and work together, as opposed to be kind of modular and bolted on. So it's maybe a little ticky-tack, but I think that's the one thing that seems kind of a little jarring with Prison Architect for me.
I guess for me, I have two points I want to talk about. One is just a little bit about how they handle the early access crowdfunding side of things. I think the one thing that I would ding them on is the fact that they did not even bother to do anything Steam form related. They just kept to the Kickstarter or the early access backed version. I'm sorry, the early access form on their own site. A lot of people went to the game on Steam thinking that they could talk to developers or ask them questions, and they just refused to go on Steam. And I think that sort of hurt them because, what you were saying a few minutes ago, Paul, regarding opening up the bug database, allowing people to input bugs and help them out, one of the biggest allures or one of the biggest draws of early access is getting all these extra eyes on the game so that you can get free bug testing and be able to solve these issues that you probably wouldn't know about until release. I know Darkest Dungeon, they've been loving the fact they have all these people picking apart the game, figuring out all these bugs and what's going on. I know Chris Park from Arkane Games, they have their whole database open there so you can input bugs. I mean, hell, I've submitted a few issues I found with their game, and they literally fix it within 48 hours. So, having all these have if they were more active on Steam, I think they would have been able to get a lot more information, a lot more things to help them out. Because one thing that we've seen, and this may be a slight tangent, but when you ask people to do multiple steps of things versus just one thing, it just becomes harder and harder to get them to commit to something. With Payday 2, with the crime fessing, they have a lot of people didn't like having to sign on to Twitter to like subscribe to someone for one of the challenges. They felt that was just a ancillary step to enjoying the game. They just wanted all the challenges to be in-game because that's just one thing. And we could really talk about the whole psychology there, but I do think they kind of mishandled that part of it. And oh, you
I do
want yep.
I do think the one thing that they did right, though, is that, right, they took, so one of the higher tiers was your ability to put your name in the game mm-hmm. and to create a bio, and even at the highest tier, right, take a picture of yourself and put you in the game.
Yeah.
They had tens of thousands of people who took advantage of the bio piece, and they started finding offensive bios that are mm-hmm. in there. So the one thing that they did from a feedback loop standpoint is that they actually put that into the game. Mm-hmm. I think that that capability, right, you can take a page out of Google, right, when you have a problem with Google's, one of Google's apps, right, you can submit a bug directly from the app or things mm-hmm. like that. So I think that that's one of the things that they did right. But I completely agree with you that I think because they were a small team and they didn't have the capability to monitor multiple locations beyond their own, right, mm-hmm. And that they had their own control over and stuff like that was probably why they shied away from it. But they definitely missed the opportunity to reach a wider audience, that's for sure.
Yeah. And the other issue, I guess, sort of start to wrap this up, I agree with you about how they sort of handle the module design. Like, it feels like a lot of elements are more tacked on rather than fully integrated. What you just said regarding the wiring systems, like, that seems a little superfluous for me. Like, for those who haven't played the game, you can set up these elaborate wiring chains, you know, set up automatic doors, CCTV cameras, a whole deal there. And there's this whole subsystem of properly wiring all the cameras to the right stations and all that stuff. And there's still a lot of systems that I don't even bother to look at. Like, you can now break down your scheduling from, you know, min, medium, max, super max. You can set up different schedules for everyone like that. And there's a whole lot of detail there. But as you said, it feels more module instead of something that someone would want to use for their entire game.
Yeah, absolutely. There's something to be said for, and they actually hide that specifically, right? That mm-hmm. Additional under the tech tree, right? You have to yeah. spend $2,000 of in dollars to unlock the, and they even call it the micromanagement,
yeah.
right? Capabilities and stuff. So, yeah, it's again, I don't know if it would be a better game if it just came fully formed from Chris's head 3 years later than this iterative process that they've done, but yeah. it's a little nitpicky, but it's definitely mm-hmm. tacked together.
Yeah, and we said this earlier in the cast, but one thing that neither of us know, and probably no one outside of Interversion will ever know, is what they were originally planning Prison Architect to be. Because as we said, they got 3 years worth of funding out of their crowdfunding model, so they were able to work on this game. And as you said, Paul, a few minutes ago, it pretty much save their company. I think it's their most successful and probably their most profitable game that Interversion has ever made.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely.
And as a quick tangent, I just want to bring this up because I was mentioning this earlier in the cast. It's just a complete opposite of what happened with Space-Based DF9, the Double Fine sort of Dwarf Fortress in space-esque game. They just completely mismatched that title. And we could spend, you know, 40 minutes breaking down everything they did wrong. But to tie a bow on this, basically everything Prison Architect did right, they basically did the opposite of. And just, it's still, I think that's going to remain probably one of the biggest red strikes on Double Fine's record for some time.
It's interesting to see, right, now that we're a couple of years into this whole crowdfunding yeah. thing, right, and we're seeing the big games hit and the big games miss and even some of the littler ones and stuff like that. It's interesting to see how it shakes out, right? It isn't that crowdfunding is dead. Stuff like Battletech, stuff like some other recent, you know, wins are still out there. But mm-hmm. it's definitely changed, right? It's definitely yeah. the land rush is over. People are more savvy, they're more understanding of what the end results are in crowdfunding. So it's still, and then you've even got this weird stuff like what's happening with Shenmue, where it's like
yeah.
crowdfunding is a barometer of interest, but it's actually going to be funded by a publisher, all that kind of weird. So yeah, again, we could spend another 40 minutes talking about that, but it's just nice to see, right? That you can't paint things with a broad brush, right? Mm-hmm. There's people go out and they do crowdfunding and they fail, like Planetary Annihilation, but then they kind of pull their ass out of the fire with Titans, mm-hmm. right? And is that enough? Is that enough to give them the credibility to be able to come back and do their next game? I hope so. We'll wait and see. But then you have people like Harebrained and Introversion and stuff like that. If Introversion came out 2 months from now and said, "Hey, here's our crowdfunding for our next game," I bet you they hit the goal. No problem.
Yeah,
right?
Yeah. There's no doubt in my mind. It's really about, I think, to sort of tie everything together. What has really become about crowdfunding and early access? It's about developing the long game. You're not just worrying about one game. You're worrying about, 2 to 3 years worth of time and money and development. As you just said, Paul, I would bet money on that too. If they announce, "Hey, we're going to have another crowdfunding, it's $40 to buy into it. Are you interested?" They're going to get funded pretty quickly because they've built and they sustain that goodwill. Same goes for The same can't be really said of Planetary Annihilation. As you said, we're sort of left unsure as to what's going to happen with them. They have fixed the game where they've made steps to fix it, but it's hard to tell what's going to happen with their next project. And that, I think, is one of the riskiest elements of crowdfunding, because you are banking not just this game, but your studio on your fans and their contributions. So if you don't deliver, people are going to remember that for the next project and the next one and so on. And as you said, it really is all kinds. We have, as same goes for Kickstarter, everyone is doing things differently, and it's hard to tell, it's really hard to tell exactly how one developer is going to really impact everyone else. One of my most popular questions, or probably one of my most annoying questions I've asked people over the last 2 years, was if they thought Kickstarter was going to be a sustainable model or not. And that's still really up in the air. And I am curious to see just what's going to happen with crowdfunding, because it has been a godsend for a lot of developers. Being able to release a game and get funding for it while building interest has been huge for them.
Absolutely. And I think that the rise of the middle mm-hmm. really has been through crowdfunding, whether it's Kickstarter or stuff like that, right? Mm-hmm. The difference between getting a large publisher backed game mm-hmm. or even having smaller publishers. I think that again, we could get off on a tangent there, but if we look at what's the crowdfunding platform that just came out that has the you can actually buy into a limited amount of equity of the thing, and they've only got the once a month, right? They're only going to come out once a month, and it's backed up by Fergus Urquhart and Tim Schafer and those guys, right? So that's an evolution of the crowdfunding model.
There's a Equity Net. I don't think that's it.
No, it's a
crowdfunder, maybe.
Nope, it's a game thing.
And we'll probably find it at the exact same time. Oh, Fig, maybe.
That's it. It's Fig.
There we go.
Yeah. So yeah. Sorry. Research Ruins podcast, but yeah. So this Fig service, right? It's Brian Fargo, it's Alex Rigopoulos, mm-hmm. It's Tim Schafer, it's Fergus Urquhart, right? These guys are, so you submit the game to them, and then the only curated games actually wind up on Fig, right? So, but then there's a capability through basically a shell corporation that you can participate at a certain level of investment. You can participate in returns on that investment. You have no creative control or actual equity in the system, but you do have the capability to make some money back. Mm. So I don't think Kickstarter is dead. I don't think crowdfunding is dead. dead. I think it's evolving. I think that the land rush of 2 years ago of, you know, either working off of nostalgia or your own personal credibility as a name in games or stuff like that, I think some of that stuff's going away and you can't necessarily bank on those things. But I think that if you do show, right, if you can show with these second wave things like Harebrained or maybe Introversion or somebody like that, you know, where they can show, or Obsidian, right?
Yeah.
They've come out with, you know, with good stuff, and they would definitely be somebody that I would back a next project on.
Yeah.
Right, they're building their own credibility within the concept of crowdfunding.
Mm-hmm.
I think that that's the next generation.
Definitely a great point, Paul. I think that really just ties this whole cast together regarding the pros and cons of crowdfunding, what we really hope to see. And I would love to talk with the Harebrained guys, so I've been trying to get them on too. But yeah, being able to consistently have successful Kickstarters and make something and building that name and that credibility around yourself, I think that's going to be really huge for crowdfunding and just being able to really take this long term. To tie this back to what we talked about in the beginning with Payday 2, they're going 3 years strong thanks to continued development. And that, I think, is the key or the goal of this crowdfunding, to be able to secure funding and secure interest for your studio for years to come. And when it works, like with Harebrained, like with Introversion, it can do amazing things for the studio.
It's a credibility game. It's a communication game, right? You can... shit breaks, stuff happens,
yeah.
But if you're open and you're transparent about it, or at least transparent enough so that the people who are backing you and the people that you need that credibility from continue to understand and work with you.
Mm-hmm.
You know, there were issues with Prison Architect where stuff, you know, wasn't going the right direction and they had to back out things and stuff like that. But you found out because every month, you know, Chris DeLay was there telling you how it was going and how it was moving. So yeah, it is, you know, crowdfunding is about credibility. Credibility is about, you know, you as a developer and you as an organization being able to have that interaction with your backers and with your audience and still be true to what you're trying to design, but still, you know, keep them interested and keep them participatory in the whole process. So, like you said, you got to go for the long game, because you can't just do the one and done and roll over into the next one. That's unfortunately what the Uber guys did, and it bit them.
Yep, you have to go for the extended time. As you said, it's about credibility. It's about building that core for your game and for your studio. Because one bad crowdfunding project and you're basically blackballed. Who's going to really support you if you put out, if you take everyone's money and say, oh, we can't work on the game, so goodbye. And then you come back 2 months later, who's going to really support you again?
Yep.
So, I think this has been a great discussion, Paul. We've had a lot of great branch-off points that we could really spend like 2-3 hours talking, but that's always the best things about these podcasts. We have so many great topics to talk about. But I think for what we set out to do with just talking about crowdfunding lately, I think this has been a great one. You mentioned while we were sort of off recording, there's of course Star Citizen, but that's 2 hours easily, right?
Oh, yeah.
It'll take us up there. So we're going to wrap things up here. Again, Paul, it's been a pleasure having you back on. Hopefully I can have you back on a lot sooner than another year or so, because we definitely had a great time here.
Thanks, Josh. I really appreciated the opportunity. It's good chatting with you.
Yep, you too. So for those of you who've been listening, thanks a lot for tuning into this episode of the Perceptive Podcast. As always, if you'd like to support GameWisdom, we have several options available. For writing a guest piece or being a future podcast guest, and I'm looking for anyone, students, enthusiasts, designers, whatever, you can find information and links under Submissions Wanted on the front page. To contribute to our ongoing Patreon campaign to secure some much-needed monthly funding for everything, you can find me on Patreon under Josh Beiser, or GameWisdom, or click that lovely Patreon banner on the front page, and any donations would be greatly appreciated. And lastly, if you like to watch, as we were talking about earlier, with my daily streams and playing video games live, you can find me on Twitch under GW Bicer most nights around 10 Eastern, where I'll be streaming a variety of games, talking about them, and you can come, hang out, ask questions, whatever. And all those videos, or majority of those, will be put onto the Game Wisdom YouTube channel, which you can find on YouTube pretty easily, or just click that handy YouTube coin that's on the front page now. So, again, thanks a lot for tuning in. Have a great rest of the week, and we will talk to you again next time. Take care.